Hello, and thanks for listening to the Ordinary Philosophy Podcast. Here, you can listen to interviews and audio renditions of pieces published at Ordinary Philosophy's website, dedicated to philosophy in the public square and the history of ideas that change the world. For more about Ordinary Philosophy, to see the photo series that accompanies this account, and to discover the sources and inspiration for each piece, please visit ordinaryphilosophy.com. Ordinary Philosophy's website and podcast are independent and ad-free, and depend on support from patrons and listeners like you. To find out more about how you can contribute to Ordinary Philosophy, please visit the Subscribe, Submit, and Support page and donate today. And if you enjoy what you read and hear at Ordinary Philosophy, please share with those you believe will enjoy it too, and please take a moment to rate and review this podcast on iTunes. I'm Amy Cools, creator and editor of Ordinary Philosophy. Episode 51, Frederick Douglass, Linsights, Part 2, Historical Society and the Hutchinson Scrapbook. Seventh day, Saturday, March 26th. As I mentioned in the first part of my account of today's journey, Lynn proves to be a Douglass treasure trove for me, especially the Lynn Museum and Historical Society. While I'm waiting to meet with a representative of the museum to look at some materials from the archives, I visit the Abolitionist Lynn exhibit upstairs. As discussed in the first part of today's account, Lynn had a particularly active and vocal abolitionist community. As I also discussed in the first part of today's account, that's what brought Douglass, laborer turned abolitionist speaker, here to Lynn. Among the artifacts I see are two posters, similar in format and general style, but strikingly different in message and tone. One shows a man with an angry face, wearing a crown made of finger bones and brandishing a chain and whip, seated upon a throne and supported by three mournful slaves, three skulls, a Bible, and a copy of the Fugitive Slave Bill, or Fugitive Slave Act, as it's commonly known, of 1850. A white-robed man, perhaps a clergyman's robe, since a judge's robe would have been black, is pouring an offering from a small cask into a fire on a small altar emblazoned, "Sacred to Slavery," while Daniel Webster, a leading senator at the time famed for his eloquence, gestures to the throne, proclaiming, "I propose to support that bill to the fullest extent," and a bearded man behind him hangs his head in sorrow, lowering a crown labeled "Freedom" from his head. Behind these figures, a barefoot escaping male slave wrestles with a pack of snarling dogs as two slave catchers on horses gallop after him. A black woman and her children run into the open arms of an abolitionist white woman, and a statue of Minerva, goddess of wisdom and trade, topples from her pedestal on the hill. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 was meant to put an end to a deeply divisive issue between the northern and southern states. Southern slave owners were enraged that northern abolitionists, grown into an energetic movement and potent political force by this time, largely due to the efforts of William Lloyd Garrison starting in the late 1820s, were aiding slaves escaping to the north. The act would not only force all northern officials to cooperate in the capture and return of escaped slaves, it would force private individuals to do so, on pain of fines and imprisonment. Northerners, especially abolitionists, saw this as an intolerable intrusion on personal conscience by forcing them to participate in a deeply immoral system, while Southerners saw this as a simple enforcement of property rights. Senator, statesman, and orator Daniel Webster personified the central conflicts between North and South at that time. A Northerner hailing from Massachusetts, he irreparably damaged his political career through his support for the Fugitive Slave Act, the final and most sweeping of many such acts passed over the decades. Northerners who admired him for his commitment to preserving the Union and for promoting the modernization of the United States into a center of finance and industry from the mostly agrarian economy it had long been, hated this cession of state and personal autonomy to Southern interests. and however much the South loved the bill, their economy was almost entirely based on agriculture and capital investment in slaves. So Webster's economic policies were intolerable to them, regardless of this compromise to preserve the Union. As Abraham Lincoln recognized from the beginning, though he too tried to find a way, peace between the states could never be attained so long as the law, founded on certain conceptions of human rights, tried to accommodate the intrinsically incompatible, peculiar institution of slavery. The second poster is a nasty, despite the author's snarky claim that it's, quote, respectful, caricature of the abolitionist women of Lynn and of black people in general. Addressed in the subtitle to the 500 ladies of Lynn who wish to marry black husbands, it's basically an elaborate telling of that schoolyard jibe, if you love so-and-so so much, why don't you marry so-and-so? As you can recognize in the quotes of the ladies in the barroom, as illustrated in the poster, oohing and aahing over the visiting Haitian ambassador, the author plays on many stereotypes of black people and of women at the time. And unfortunately, most of us get the twisted jokes in the quotes in the poster because these stereotypes persist to this day. The person who created this poster in 1839 could not have foreseen that one of Lynn's future black residents, Frederick Douglass, would go on to become one of Lynn's and America's most loved and admired citizens, and would be appointed to the high office of United States Consul General to Haiti in 1889. I, for one, would get some satisfaction out of time traveling to visit the author of this poster and inform him of these historical developments, just to see the look on his face. Douglass was too dignified a man himself to engage in such a prank if it were possible. Throughout his life, he practiced great self-discipline in keeping to the moral high ground. A seamstress and textile artist myself, I enjoy the next exhibit I see, an exhibit of needlework artifacts created by the girls and women of Lynn's abolitionist community to raise money for the abolitionist cause. The sampler is a basic design. The only thing differentiating it from other samplers of the period is the cause it raised money for. The other pieces, through words and images, remind their owners not to forget the slaves' plight while enjoying the freedom and comfort of their own daily lives. The exhibit is filled with many more interesting artifacts and information, but to keep this account from becoming too long, I'll refocus my attention on the main object of my visit here today. Britt arrives. She so kindly takes time out of her day off to come and meet me, and greets me with a cart of artifacts. One is a folder filled with ephemera relating to Douglass, mostly newspaper clippings, and the other is an old scrapbook entitled Memorabilia of the Hutchinson Family. She reminds me of what Nicole Bro, education and research specialist, had informed me by email. The Lynn Museum's archival materials are now housed at the Phillips Library at the Peabody Essex Museum. She encourages me to visit, and I long to do so, but as I've been telling you, more and more to my regret, I only have 2 weeks for this trip and have no time to go. I hope to be able to follow up in future, and now have yet one more good resource for original sources. So knowing time this short this morning, too, I begin with the exciting artifact here before me, the Hutchinson Family Scrapbook. It opens with a portrait of John Hutchinson. He's quite a handsome man, I think, with beautiful eyes. Douglass traveled on board with the Hutchinsons, as he put it in his Life and Times, the sweet singers of anti-slavery and the good time coming, when he sailed to the British Isles on August 6, 1847, on self-imposed exile when he felt the information contained in his newly published narrative endangered his freedom. The Hutchinson Family Singers Vocal Group was founded by John Hutchinson with his brothers Asa, Jesse, and Judson. The Hutchinson family was originally from New Hampshire, as Douglass described, but had many connections to Lynn. John saw a concert of a European singing troupe and was inspired to form his own in that style. The family later performed in Lynn, and John and his wife, generally known as Patch, settled there, on high rock at the north part of the city, not far from the second Lynn home of the Douglass family. When Jesse became musical director of the group, he stopped singing as often. But all of the brothers and sisters, as well as many spouses and other extended family members, joined in as full-time or occasional members. The group broke up into two tribes since the brothers didn't always get along. Like so many brothers in bands together, like the Great Kinks and maybe not as great Oasis. But both groups always were billed as the Hutchinson Family Singers. There are so many wonderful artifacts here. New thrills every time I open the page. There's a letter from Susan B. Anthony, great abolitionist, woman's rights leader, and friend of Douglas, who I'll discuss at greater length in a later account. In the letter, Susan B. Anthony is sending condolences for the death of his sister Abby, an especially talented member of the group, and also, as Anthony says here, dedicated to women's rights cause. There's also a printed tribute from Abby Hutchinson to her brother Jesse following his death on May 15, 1853. She had replaced him as the fourth member of the quartet when he stopped singing as much to become manager, and then she took over as manager for him when he died. There's a note here from Julia Ward Howe, who wrote Battle Hymn of the Republic, which consisted of new lyrics to the tune of John Brown's Body, a song about Douglas's fiery abolitionist friend who led the raid on Harper's Ferry. Both Battle Hymn of the Republic and John Brown's Body were popular Civil War hymns, for the Northern side, of course. There's a poster for the second abolitionist reunion at Tremont Temple in Boston, September 22, 1890. As you may remember from my account of my day in Boston visiting Douglas sites, he spoke here often, and as you can see from the poster, he shares the stage with John Hutchinson, who closes the meeting with Howe's Battle Hymn of the Republic. There are two portraits of Frederick Douglass here, and also there's a Hutchinson family paper celebrating over 25 years as a group, with a ringing endorsement by feminist leader and Douglass's friend, Elizabeth Cady Stanton. As with the exhibit upstairs, I find there are so many interesting things here to share, and I could continue on and on, but this account would grow meandering and very long. It's going to be pretty long regardless. So I'll return to the central subject of this account and publish more photos of artifacts I find here today in later accounts as they pertain to the story. And I'll tell you now about my most exciting discovery of the day. Do you remember the drawing I included from the first part of my Lynn Journey account of the cover page for the Fugitive song written by Jesse and dedicated to Frederick Douglass? In 1874, Douglass wrote a letter to John Hutchinson mentioning Jesse. The group was often called the Tribe of Jesse, even long after his death. And it's here in the scrapbook. Yes, I'm holding an original letter written by Douglass himself, in my own two hands. Well, archivist gloved hands anyway. And of course I don't remove it from the scrapbook. Just carefully turn it over to read both sides. Like I've said many times before, artifacts and physical sites have a very strong effect on me emotionally, which is what keeps me from being just an armchair history enthusiast and drives me out on the road. So, of course, I get the chills all over again and feel more than a bit teary-eyed. But anyway, here's the full text of the letter. Biddeford, November 18th, 1874. My dear John, I have only time while on the wing as I am to tell you that you made me very much obliged to you for the little pamphlet you kindly put into the hands before last night in Lynn, containing biographical sketches of the several members of your remarkably musical family. No apology was needed for its publication. All who have listened, as I have done, to the concord of several sounds from members of the Tribe of Jesse want more of the music and wish to know more of the persons from whom it comes. I especially have reason to feel a grateful interest in the whole Hutchinson family, for you have sung the yokes from the necks and fetters from the limbs of my race, and dared to be true to humanity against all danger to worldly prosperity and reputation. You have dared to sing for a cause first and for cash afterward. I know a few instrumentalities which have done more for liberty and temperance than have your voices. But I only took this moment simply to thank you for the pamphlets and not to speak in the praise of the dear family. Yours very truly, Frederick Douglass. At long last, and with little time to spare, I finish looking at the scrapbook and turn to the other clippings and ephemera I find in the Douglass file folder. I find an old newspaper clipping here that's very interesting, unique in its details, yet generally characteristic of how high the tensions were between abolitionists and supporters of slavery, and how tight-knit abolitionist communities were. New Bedford, as discussed earlier in the series, was one such community. Lynn and Boston both have a strong history of abolitionism as well. John Adams, a Bostonian of many years, was the only one among our several first presidents who not only didn't own slaves, but consistently regarded it a great wrong. The clipping tells a story of George Latimer, a former slave who escaped with his wife Rebecca to Baltimore, then on to Boston, where George was arrested. After Latimer's freedom was finally purchased, he and his wife settled in Lynn. I had read this story in my research on Douglass. It was disputes over slaves escaping north, such as the Latimers, that led to passage of the Fugitive Slave Act, since the slave catchers had pursued Latimer into a free state. And as you can see in the newspaper account on the website, Douglass, William Lloyd Garrison, and Wendell Phillips were champions for Latimer's cause and held meetings in Boston's Faneuil Hall, where I visited yesterday. You'll also see that Jesse and John Hutchinson were among the activists protesting Latimer's treatment, that the pastor of Tremont Temple, Samuel Caldwell, paid the $400 that purchased his freedom, or as Douglass might have said, paid his ransom, and that Latimer and his wife were taken in by people on Joy Street, on Beacon Hill in Boston. I walked that street just yesterday as well. I find many other old newspaper clippings in this folder, some of which I've shared with you already in the first part of my account of today's visit to Lynn, others which I'll share with you as they relate to my further discoveries on my Douglass journey, and still others I'm happy to share upon request. But I'll go ahead and end this account here for time's sake, and soon follow this with a tale of my next day's discoveries. Again, my heartfelt thanks goes out to all at the Lynn Museum and Historical Society. Thank you so much to Nicole Brilt for arranging my visit, Britt Bowen, who gave me access to historical artifacts for study, the kind ladies who greeted me and showed me around, and to everyone else there who makes this place a beautiful place to visit and a great resource. As always, thank you for listening, have a wonderful day, and I look forward to any questions, comments, or suggestions that you may wish to offer in response to this account.